The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So when Gil teaches this class usually, and when he does, he kind of notice, kind of gently wades into a topic and then sort of quietly drops some Dharma gold and then kind of like circles it, like circles around it to sort of illustrate it, and then brings in these like beautiful metaphors and gradually moves you into a place of deeper understanding. And every time I teach, I try to vomit up everything I know all at once. That's the pedagogical approach. And I know that's bad teaching strategy, you know, but I don't know. I can't seem to break the habit. And, you know, Gil actually is my mentor. So in some ways, I'm his fault, actually. So anyway, we're here together and, I want to talk about taking the backward ethical step. And so culture and Dharma intersect in many ways, and in a sense Dharma is a culture. But one of the effects of the collision of this culture and an Asian monastic lineage is that you can have the sense of that Dharma is supposed to always feel good. And it is supposed to feel good. It is supposed to liberate. It's supposed to feel good a lot of the time. It's real. We need calm abiding. We need pleasantness. We need blessedness. And yet much of the path and part of why it's actually not very popular, despite all the hype, you know, to actually follow the path, it's not very popular, is something like the centrality of the wholesome unpleasant. There is such a thing, believe it or not, as the wholesome unpleasant. And part of our path of practice is really actually honoring this, honoring the wholesome unpleasant. And so the question for today, the question for this time, question that's rumbling in my own heart is, how do we become better people, ethically speaking? How do we become better? And it feels like the world is begging for us to evolve. Yeah. The Buddha says we assume permanence in a way. We assume the opposite of the three characteristics. We assume permanence. We fail to see fluidity and plasticity. And I think we do this in a sense with our own ethical being, that we grow up, we sort of establish ourselves as a good person, and then we just keep going. We keep doing that. And that's fine, but what if we considered our own development as a moral creature, as wild and unpredictable and full of twists and turns and a kind of lifelong endeavor, a lifelong question that is maybe never fully resolved. And the question is something like, what does goodness entail? That's a deeper question than we suppose, I feel. Now, we know that sila, ethical conduct, is central to the Buddhist path. And it really is. It's like sometimes there's I'll be talking to a practitioner who's diligent and committed in practice, but they're stuck in a particular way. And sometimes I'll just have the intuition like to ask about their sila. And often what we find is that there's some way that the conduct is actually not conducive to peace, not conducive to surrender. Now, Ajahn Chah famously said that sila, samadhi, panya, ethical conduct, mind training, and wisdom are all the same fruit. It's like pit, flesh, and skin of a mango. And in our own ethical tradition, this Buddhist tradition, ethics is usually defined in the negative way, meaning it's depicted as what we refrain from doing. We take the precepts and refrain from killing, from stealing, from sexual harm, from these things. So this is Bhikkhu Bodhi. The Buddha points to two mental qualities as the underlying safeguards of morality, thus as protectors of both the individual and society as a whole. Hiri is an innate sense of shame over moral transgression. Ottapa is moral dread, fear of the results of wrongdoing. The Buddha calls these two states the bright guardians of the world. Hiri has an internal reference. It's rooted in self-respect and induces us to shrink from wrongdoing out of a feeling of personal honor. Ottapa, fear of wrongdoing, has an external orientation. It is the voice of conscience that warns us of dire consequences of moral transgression, blame and punishment by others, and the painful karmic results. Given the intricate interconnections that hold between all living forms, to make the sense of shame and the fear of wrong the guardians of our own minds is to make ourselves guardians of the world. As the roots of morality, these two qualities sustain the entire efficacy of the Buddha's liberating path. Now you'll notice these two guardians, yeah, Hiri and Ottapa, are about avoiding harmful action. And if we do that, if we commit to that, if even a small proportion of people commit in a deep way to that, that is earth-shaking. But what motivates us proactively to do good? What if the bliss of blamelessness entails more than abstaining from overt harm? I'm slightly haunted by the thought. Maybe I owe more, much more, to the welfare of others than I think I owe, than I'm told I owe. Sometimes if you move carefully through the forest, breathing like the ones in the old stories who could cross a shimmering bed of leaves without a sound, you come to a place whose only task is to trouble you with tiny but frightening requests, conceived out of nowhere, but in this place beginning to lead everywhere. Requests to stop what you're doing right now and to stop what you're becoming while doing it. Questions that can make or unmake a life. Questions that have patiently waited for you. Questions that have no right to go away. David White. So how do we mature ethically, and how does Dharma practice actually support this unfolding? Now, in my own maturation, incomplete as it is, my own maturation as an ethical being, very quickly the Dharma made clear the kind of instant karma of causing harm. It's, you get sensitive and it becomes painful to do harm. And of course, I had to grieve all the harm that I had done. And become better, become more careful in body, speech, and mind. And as I'm saying, refraining from harm has great benefits. The kind of ripples of safety, of joy, impact many. And however deeply activist we are in our lives, a lot of the trace of a life is just in the very simple relationships that surround our circle. And so, yeah, there is this deep kind of refraining from overt harm. But in a way, I feel like that can lull us into a sense of ethical laziness, that if I'm refraining from harm, it's okay, it's all okay. But waking up is always waking up to more. And for much of this country, George Floyd is a kind of awakening. In his eulogy for Floyd, Reverend Al Sharpton said something like, "For 400 years, this country's had its knee on our neck." And so for many people, many white folks like myself, we're, I think, being invited to take the backward step that Dogen spoke of. Yeah. And I don't know the Zen tradition well at all. I know Max does a retreat on Dogen, IRC each year, and this is a striking image. So Dogen says, "You should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your own original face will be manifest. If you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay." There's something about that phrase, the backward step, that came to mind as I was reflecting about this morning, that we're being asked to take a kind of a backwards ethical step. And part of the growing pains of ethical maturation entail a measure of disorientation. Almost all growth, maybe we say, entails a measure of disorientation, of uncertainty as we take the next step of moving into uncharted territory in some way, to actually begin to sense a new ethical world. And there's some research, you know, kind of in moral philosophy, neuroethics, this sort of marriage brain science and ethical moral philosophy, moral psychology. And so this is Yoel Enbar and colleagues says, what we hold to be moral or immoral dictates many of our thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors. When something resides in the moral domain, it takes on unique properties beyond those of typical attitudes. We experience our moral convictions as objective truths rather or facts. In the same way 2 + 2 = 4 and not 5, we experience our moral convictions as inherently right or wrong without room for negotiation. The moral convictions individuals and societies hold are fundamental to both what makes humanity thrive as well as what makes it suffer. But we know very little about moralization, the process in which something that was previously morally neutral gets imbued with moral properties. It is through this process that individuals elevate social issues, policies, behaviors, even objects to a moral and sacred standing and formulate their concomitant moral convictions. It's through this process that individuals elevate social issues, policies, behaviors, even objects to a moral and sacred standing and formulate the associated moral convictions. Something that blended into samsara becomes moralized, How does this happen? What they're really pointing to is, I would say, how the heart grows, how the circle of empathy actually expands, how we come to care about more, morally speaking. And they formulated a kind of model that is so striking because it's so consistent with a lot of what I feel in my own Dharma exploration. So if I may, I'm going to share a PowerPoint slide. This is, I don't know what I think about that, but okay. So here you see a kind of scale on the top from something that was not moralized, maybe it's police violence, racialized police violence, to a strong moralization on the right side. And these researchers formulated what they call the push-pull model of moralization. And on the push side are moral emotions and cognitions, ideas, and then pulling away from this process of moralization is hedonism and dissonance reduction strategies. I'll say a little bit more about that. So here they fill out the model a little bit more. You see, like, yeah, we have these moral intuitions. We have moral piggybacking, yeah, where we start to trace out the implications of our views, what we already believe, imply perhaps a different course of action. And then pulling us our sacrifices of pleasure, the pleasure of conformity, of not standing out, and of rationalizations. So I'll sort of unpack some of this. And maybe I'll just I can put the model in the chat. So we have the push of moral emotion, of empathy, of compassion, hiri and otapa. Disgust is a kind of moral emotion that motivates a lot of our ethical behavior, actually. And it seems like emotionally laden intuitions, sort of gut responses, seem to drive a lot of our moral decision making. It's less about rational reflection, but ideas still count, reasoning still counts. We have beliefs about non-harming, about sila, about rights, about power, about fairness. And then there's the pull of hedonic motivations. What might I have to give up? In their example, it's like, I like the taste of meat, and so I don't want to think about animal rights. I might have to give up some unearned privilege. I might have to give up the pleasure of conforming. And then there's the way in which sometimes we feel into our own, the incoherence of our own ethical life. Yeah. That there's something unjustifiable about our ethical life. We have an inkling that maybe we can do more or do better or do something differently, but we don't actually want to change or let go. And so we paper it over, we rationalize it. Delusion serves to justify greed and hatred. We are not rational animals, we are rationalizing animals, as Heinlein said. And the Dharma has a place in all of this. We're developing our moral being, all of it, all of, you know, Krishnamurti said, this is like in his own journal, taking a walk in Ojai, he said, why is it that we seem to be losing the highly vulnerable quality of sensitivity to all the things about us, not just our own problems and turmoils, to actually be sensitive, not about something, but just to be sensitive, to be vulnerable, like that new leaf, which was born a few days ago to face storms, rain, darkness, and light. When we're vulnerable, we seem to get hurt. Being hurt, we withdraw into ourselves, build a wall around ourselves, become hard, cruel. But when we are vulnerable without any ugly, brutal reactions, vulnerable to all the movements of one's own being, vulnerable to the world, so sensitive that there is no regret, no wounds, no self-imposed discipline, then there is the quality of measureless existence. To practice is to become sensitive. And that sensitivity is held in the rest, in the kind of ocean of equanimity, but it is sensitivity nonetheless. And in our moral evolution, the conscious experience of suffering, that is the heart of morality, yeah? That's the heart, that we can suffer, that other beings can suffer, can know that they're suffering. We come to develop an acute sensitivity to this, to, right? The truth of suffering is to be comprehended. We develop our moral emotions by knowing suffering intimately, right here, right in this system. We know it with clarity. We know its poignancy. We know those times sitting, that retreat, that moment where it's like the weight of suffering feels like the weight of samsara itself. It's so poignant. We're so, so tender. And through that sensitivity, we begin to recognize that this poignancy haunts all of the world. The whole world is begs the moral question. We moralize all of our experience, in other words. And so we start to feel like, oh yeah, more and more carries ethical weight. And wherever there is suffering, there should be ethics. Wherever there is suffering, there should be sila. And there's suffering everywhere. Yeah. So in our own path of practice, we begin to release some of our own pain. You know, we heal ourselves, our own hearts, so that the pain of the world doesn't so much resonate with our wounds, but with our heart. I've been sitting actually for the last 10 days. So I'm just doing self-retreat. And the heart and body, we vitalize the heart, mind. We open, we release, and become more sensitive. Moralize more and more of experience. In that model that I shared, the pull of hedonism and what they call dissonance reduction strategies, these rationalizations, they're really all about feeling. They're all about feeling. Whether it's hedonism or rationalization, Ajahn Sajito said, all dhammas converge on feeling. In my own practice, I found that to be so. All dhammas converge on feeling. so much of our path, so much of the kind of mechanisms of compulsivity, of release, converge on feeling, on allowing what I spoke of before we sat, allowing the tightly bound wire of our own feeling to unfurl and to follow it into the place where it terminates, to follow it with wisdom, with equanimity, to the place where it terminates in love, or peace, or delight, or compassion. So we start to have a courage. We start to have courage. We start to have a kind of egoic flexibility, not to defend our life anymore. You know, it's like we're so desperate to rationalize our life, to plaster over the places of incoherence, the places where we're out of step with our own deepest values. But we start to have the courage to drop this habit, to feel actually the pain of moral incoherence, the unjustifiability of pieces of our life, the places where the moralization will grow. And so we're relinquishing, in a sense, our familiar understanding with ourselves. We fixate our ethical self, maybe more than almost anything else. I am good. And to be identified with being good is different than serving goodness. To be identified with being good is different than serving goodness. And so we start to develop some flexibility in how fluidity in how the ethical self fixates. This is tricky terrain because on the one hand, Hiri and Otapa capitalize on that fixation. Yeah? I don't want to be a bad person. I don't want you to see me as bad. That can have onward leading benefits, yeah? But it's complicated. It's complicated, yeah? Because then if it's like, no, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. What happens when I see something in this world that I had not fully let into my heart? The rights of the most vulnerable in a society, the extreme poverty around the globe, our responsibilities to non-human animals, our responsibilities to generations that will inherit the karma of our greed and hatred. And so we become connoisseurs of moral incoherence, of the unjustifiability of our life. And we seek to grow from it rather than erase it. And some of this entails grieving because the enormity of samsara, the enormity of suffering, actually lands in your heart in a new way. And that's not just hard, but that's hard, yeah? A sense of responsibility grows. Maybe a spirit of renunciation, yeah, and trying to mitigate the that one half of the model, yeah, of actually relinquishing, renunciation. This path is about letting go. And so we have to relinquish certain kinds of hedonism, certain preference to feel a certain way. There are trade-offs of comfort or power or money, resource. But this should be familiar to us. We have been practicing to let go the whole time. Yeah? We know the power of relinquishment. So we take the backward ethical step. Take the backward ethical step. After the death of a close friend, Norman Fisher wrote, when someone you love is gone, that person can't do anything anymore. This means that you have to do something, or that you have to do something differently. Somehow you, who are connected to that person, have to do what they can no longer do. You have to ask yourself, now that this has happened, what will I do? What will I do in place of my friend? A month ago, George Floyd became our friend. And so we have to ask, like, what, yeah. What will we do in place of our friend? You know? Let's sit for a minute. So thank you for your attention and as always, please pick up whatever is onward leading and leave the rest behind. You can hear that I'm trying to trace out my own path to an ethically justifiable life, yeah? And for better or worse, you're kind of coming along for the ride, yeah? And we're in it together.